here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the early years of the AIDS epidemic were marked by misinformation and fear, with some similarities to what we've seen with COVID-19. We'll talk to a former state representative about Wisconsin's public health action in the era of AIDS. First, the COVID-19 pandemic has changed a lot of things about our day-to-day lives, from the ability to go out to stores or restaurants to how we interact with friends and family. For a lot of people, the biggest change is how and where we work. While many people still have to physically go to work in places like hospitals or grocery stores, most people with office jobs have been working from home. And there are some signs that working from home, full-time or maybe part-time, could be here to stay. Clive Thompson is a journalist who covers science and technology. His recent piece for the New York Times Magazine is titled, "What If Working From Home Goes On Forever?" Clive, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Well, how widespread is work from home really in the last few months?
Very high. By some estimates, by a recent MIT estimate, it might be as high as half of all American workers are currently working from home. And that is that's way bigger than before. Before the pandemic, it was more like maybe 5 to 10%, you know, probably thereabouts.
And as I mentioned, there is a divide here in this country among types of jobs that we might not have thought of before. Those that clearly can't work from home and those that can. This isn't touching a lot of people with those jobs that they have to be at, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the other half of the people, they're all in jobs that basically need face-to-face, right? So a lot of healthcare, transportation workers, aspects of sort of, you know, cleaning things up and maintenance, those jobs cannot be done remotely. You've got to be there. So they're still physically there on the job. Yeah.
For those jobs we can do at home, though, you talk to people in a lot of lines of work, government offices, corporations, and more. Working from home for a lot of these companies is working. Can you talk about the experience that they've seen?
Sure. Working from home right now has been, I mean, it's been very interesting. I talked to dozens of people that have shifted to full-time work from home, and it involves a lot of stuff they didn't have to do before. One of them is all those meetings you used to do face-to-face that were, you know, pretty quick, like you could just say hi to someone, you have to now plan and organize a time to talk to them. So a lot of people were telling me that they felt like they were just in incessant meetings, like Zoom calls, Hangouts, Microsoft Team calls, whatever it is. They also said that they're doing a lot more, you know, communication. Because again, like if I'm in an office, I can call across the room to ask someone something. But now you have to write them a message, right? Whether that's email or text message or a message on a Slack channel, you've got to do that. And that actually is slower. It takes more work than just calling across the room. So people told me that their work felt like it had kind of ballooned because it involves so much more communication than they would have thought they did physically in the office.
But it sounds like a lot of places are now thinking, hey, we're doing well with this. We're being productive. We may not necessarily go back, or we may not fully go back. Talk about the move to make at least some part of work from home permanent.
Well, sure. I mean, like what every CEO that I spoke to said, and employees too, is that they were all surprised and impressed at how high their productivity stayed even while they were working from home. A lot of these bosses, keep in mind, they had resisted letting people work from home. They had employees for years saying, I want to work from home. And the bosses were saying, no way, not happening. Because they were worried, frankly, that if they couldn't clap eyes on people, they'd just be like Netflixing and chilling all day long, right? But what they found is that their productivity is not only as high as it was before, but maybe even higher. And so now they're thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe for the, like, there's some workers that are desperate to get back to the office. Let's be clear, right? They're extroverts, or their home situation is completely untenable. But there is a significant minority. I would argue a big minority that has looked at this and said, I think I'd like to stay here at least much of the time and maybe all the time. And the bosses are realizing, well, maybe we'll do that.
We heard from Margaret on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says, after my employer spent literally decades saying work from home was impossible, They were able to make it happen for 6,000 employees almost overnight. Margaret goes on, it's been great. I absolutely love not having to go farther than 30 steps for my commute. She goes on, she likes that her wardrobe is down to T-shirts and shorts,
yeah.
The good coffee. Let's start with that first point, though. Margaret's boss said, no, there's no way, we can't do this. All of a sudden, Margaret's employer and so many others turn on a dime.
Yep, that's right. I mean, this is what the CTO of Accenture, which is a huge 500,000 person company, he said to me that he felt like they had done 3 years of adaptation in 3 weeks, right? Because they, you know, they did exactly what her company did. They sort of said, well, not so much work from home. Then they were forced to do it. And so this adaptation has happened rapidly. And I think, you know, I think it's brought all these benefits that not only the employers didn't expect, but, you know, the employees are discovering some of the stuff too. Like that idea of not having to commute is huge. A lot of people have told me that, like, they have got back an hour and a half a day that they normally had in a commute. They have that now. That's time that they can, you know, do other stuff, maybe do errands, just chill out and read, see their family, you know, more often. If you're in a situation where that works well at home, it's really quite fantastic.
We're talking to Clive Thompson, journalist and author, about working from home during the pandemic and maybe beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had to make the transition to working at home? Love it? Hate it? Mixed feelings? Would you want to keep doing it? Or do you have to go to work? Do you wish you could work at home? Would you if you could? Call 800-642-1234. Clive, you talked to a lot of people about some of the stumbling blocks in communication that you were touching on a little bit earlier. And there was some advice and some interesting experiments with video meetings to change the way, make it less awkward. Can you share some of what you found out for us?
Sure, yeah. So most people... I pretty quickly into this work from home thing started noticing that video could be quite exhausting, right? Like if you do like 5 or 6 video meetings in a row, like people were telling me they were just, they would have to lie flat down for hours. There was nothing left, no gas in the tank. Why is that? Well, you know, I talked to a lot of scientists who study the way we communicate and the way we communicate via video. And what they all told me is that part of the problem is that video chat online sort of breaks a lot of the natural ways that we pay attention to each other, right? Like normally we sort of pay attention to each other's body language and we respond to it and we get into what they call synchrony with them. Like we're able to sort of understand and predict our conversational partner's internal state even before they announce it. This is even more crucial if you're in a meeting with like 10 people. You're sort of scoping the room and figuring everything out. And it's just a lot harder to do that when you're staring at your web camera, because you're seeing everyone staring right at you, which is super awkward and weird. Like it's actually threatening. Like normally humans only stare at someone when like they intend to do something terrible, right? You know, and yet, so we're sitting here looking into our cameras and having everyone stare at you. You go to a meeting of 10 people and everyone is staring at everyone else. Like that's an incredibly weird experience. So basically, what some of the tips and tricks that have come up are this. One is stand back a little bit from your camera so the camera can see more of your body. That allows people to observe more of you and they can develop more of that synchrony with you. Some people have started turning the camera off, just doing it with audio, and they find that less exhausting, right? Like just have a conversation where you're talking. There's something about processing that staring face that can freak you out. So, and the other one is really just be a little judicious in how often you do video. A lot of people told me they started off 10 video meetings a day, and a month in they're like, let's do 2 video meetings a day. Let's do the 2 that are really crucial because I will go nuts if I have to do more. So yeah, that's what I've been hearing.
My favorite example from your piece is a therapist who had to, you know, switch to doing remote therapy sessions. And instead of staring into the camera at each other, they did like they did in the in-person session and sat kind of parallel to the camera, and they could look at each other, you know, when they needed to.
Right, exactly. Very clever. Because what he told me is, all right, so he's a psychiatrist, and when he sees a patient, they will, you know, they will lie down on the couch, and he will sit next to them, and he'll be looking away from them. They will not be staring at each other. If they want to, they can turn their head and see each other, but you know, they will talk, you know, sort of in parallel tracks, like it's co-presence. It feels comfortable. So they tried doing, you know, the stare at each other Zoom thing. Totally did not work. And then I think it was a patient who said, why don't we try this? You look off to one side. I'll look off to one side and we'll talk. And it actually recreated that sense of being there. If they wanted to turn their head and look, they could see, but they didn't have to. So I think there's, like, in one sense, sometimes I think maybe we're just at the early stages of figuring out these cool hacks and tricks that make it easier for us to be together online, because we haven't really had to do this at mass scale yet. Right now we are. So maybe we'll develop some wisdom about how to do this better.
We're talking to journalist Clive Thompson right now about his recent piece, What If Working Home Goes On Forever, for the New York Times Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been working from home in the last few months, what has your experience been like? If you had already been working at home, do you have something to share, some advice to share with people who are just getting into it now for the first time? Would you continue to work from home if your employer asked you to or gave you the option? What issues, what roadblocks have you had working from home? Are you sick of it and want to go back? And if you can't work from home, do you wish you could? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Excuse me. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with journalist Clive Thompson about his recent piece for the New York Times Magazine, What If Working From Home Goes On Forever? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're working from home, what has your experience been like? How are your employers supporting you working from home, or how are they not? What more could you use? Do you want to keep working from home, or are you sick of it? Do you wish you could do it more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Peter, who says, I want to go back to the office. I miss collaborating in person on whiteboards. I miss super fast internet that will never exist in rural Wisconsin. Cookouts. Nobody's going to buy donuts for disparate coworkers. We're so much better together. And that's a concern you heard from some people, Clive, that, you know, yes, some things are more efficient, but we're missing that dynamic that happens when you have people together. Can you talk about those concerns?
Yeah. Several CEOs told me about this, and so did some people who sort of essentially study corporate culture, right? Like, what makes a company function really well? What makes them feel cohesive? What makes everyone trust each other so they can say crazy things or difficult things? What makes them come up with new really good ideas, right? And this is a funny thing, because, like, a lot of that glue that stitches a company together comes from these moments that would seem like you're sort of wasting time, right? Like, you know, like dallying over lunch because you're talking about Game of Thrones, or poking your nose into someone's cubicle and then you sort of get in a conversation that goes for like half an hour. All these, you know, weird little ways that you bump into one another in the office. People often complain that it slows down their work or distracts them. And that's true, actually. And that's part of the reason you get higher productivity when people work from home. They're not interrupted so much. But some of those interruptions, even if they're a pain in the butt in the short run, are part of that glue that creates a corporate culture that lets people have really big ideas or make these connections that you wouldn't normally make because you don't necessarily talk to the person in accounting until you run into them, you know, getting coffee. And really big ideas can come from that. Like, historically, a lot of companies have had their great big product idea come when someone from this team just happens to run into this other person at a bar after work, and they talk and they come up with an idea. So the lesson really is, and it's kind of interesting, is that, like, you know, work from home can be more efficient, but companies also need a certain amount of inefficiency to generate that culture that really makes them thrive.
Now, how about the bottom line side of things? Because I imagine, and you talk about this a little in your piece, some business owners thinking, wait a minute, if we could do all this work from home, why am I paying all this rent for all this office space?
No, absolutely. I mean, I had a couple of people tell me, particularly in like smaller companies that are still growing, where like the real estate is really a big chunk of the budget, right? And they're like, oh my goodness, why did we do this? Why did we ever like invest in this great big huge, you know, office when maybe we really need one third of that space, right? And I think it could be quite an interesting reckoning over the next few years, you know? I mean, definitely there will be companies that will say we need you know, we need some of that space because there are people that we need to get together. But in other cases, they'll go, yeah, let's downsize. And we've already seen that happen, right? So Nationwide Insurance, that's a very large company. They took advantage of work from home to close, I think it was 5 or 6 branch offices, basically. I mean, they've been thinking of closing them for some time, but this just pushed them to go, let's pull the trigger now. Like, it's clear that everyone in those outlets can function really well without those offices. We're going to get rid of them. We're going to, you know, focus on several key offices that they know they need to have. I think we'll see more decisions like that going forward. Yeah.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Sister Bay. Scott, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Scott?
Good. Well, I'm a performer and opera singer by trade, and I'm also a professor at DePaul University in Chicago, and live part-time here in Sister Bay, Wisconsin, and have had to take all of our private voice lessons online. And it's caused quite a problem for a lot of students that are looking to come into school now, and you know, how does this look for them? You know, can we still get an education online? Now, we are trying to do some sort of online and in person, but for the most part, this last semester has all been online, and it's actually worked pretty darn well, I have to say. The students didn't really take to it incredibly well at first. A lot of them felt unmotivated, but, you know, as educators, that's our job. So we've had to take this completely online, set up little home studios. And even in my business, we're doing all little concerts from home and things like that, you know, to keep opera companies and symphony orchestras up and running and have the interest stay there.
Scott, wow. Thanks a lot for sharing that pretty unique experience, Clive. What do you think? A performance and voice coaching and education, of course, all happening online now.
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you, when I first started researching this, I thought, okay, you know, there must be limits to what you can do remotely. And I'm sure there are. But I was surprised by the number of activities and types of work that people could do remotely that I would never in a million years have guessed, right? So, for example, one chef, I suppose, this wasn't even in the story. I didn't really figure out a place to put him. But this one chef that I spoke to, you know, his restaurant shut down during coronavirus. And so he's like, well, I need some money. And so he quickly set up a website and offered to do one-on-one cooking lessons with a specific sort of pandemic twist. He would say, what you're going to do is just use your phone and show me what ingredients you've got in your kitchen right now, and I'm going to figure out an awesome meal and show you how to cook it. So you don't need to go out and shop, right? Which is very brilliant, right? It's like, you know, social distancing. And so he started that, and he got all sorts of clients just in the first month. And even when he goes back to cooking and, you know, back in the restaurant, he's probably going to keep the side gig going. So yeah, there are chefs who are doing remote chef work. A lot of necessity is a mother of invention, as they say.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. That makes me think of the story you opened your piece with, Clive, about a traveling salesman, basically a guy who would fly to places to demo, what was it, robot vacuum cleaners to hotels and airports and things like that. And he really, really changed the way he's working in a way that might stick. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So sales, I was very interested when I started my research into what the heck was going on with sales. Mm-hmm. Because sales is, you know, if you're selling something that's expensive, you know, like thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars for a contract, you know, that is very much a face-to-face thing. Typically, people fly out, they go, they press the flesh, they have lunch, they really want to trust this person, right? And so, you know, selling something on a robot, an expensive robot, normally they'd want to see that thing. You know, you drag it out to where they are. And yet I discovered that even a lot of sales seems to be working fairly well online. People were discovering this guy, the salesperson, was selling, closing multiple contracts a day with hotels, with airports, with cleaning companies. And all they really needed was just to talk to him and see a video of the robot doing its work. And they were like, yeah, that looks great. And he realized their reactions were no different than they had been when he had flown across the country with a big heavy robot and set it up. They would look at it and go, yeah, that's great. I'll take 3. And that's exactly what they were doing online. So now he's thinking, you know, it's not that he will never travel again, but probably he'll do a lot more sales just like this. So yeah, sales doesn't always need to be face-to-face.
Yeah, and that work travel, I wonder, because that sales guy, he had to, you know, fly there, fly back all the time, maybe stay overnight, put all this time into getting this presentation ready, and now he can have a 10-minute Zoom or whatever chat. Is business travel really going to just, I don't know, not disappear, I guess, but go way back?
Whoa, yeah. I mean, I didn't really investigate that directly, so I couldn't tell you what the current prognostications are amongst experts who really look at that. But I will tell you that the great majority of business folks I talked to said they can imagine that business travel is going to be very curtailed for many, many months and may never quite look like it did before, right? You never say never. You know, if there's a good vaccine and it really seems to eradicate this thing, you know, people like traveling. They enjoy going to conferences. They enjoy, I mean, salespeople actually, they don't just travel because they have to. They enjoy it. But, you know, they're very social people. But yeah, I can't imagine it ever goes back to quite the way it was before. It's got to come down by some percentage.
Clive, 30 seconds left, and I wanted to ask you about this, the Zoom meetings or whatever online meetings of the future. We may have cartoons representing us.
Yeah, some people are actually thinking, okay, if it's hard to stare at a person all the time, what if we just did this with kind of like, you know, avatars, like kind of the way you see in a video game like Animal Crossing? What if we got together like that? Wouldn't it be more fun? And so I actually saw some demos of early products that do that, and they're kind of interesting. They're kind of fun. I'm not sure how many people would like it, but I bet a lot of people would give it a try. You know, here, we're going to meet together as cartoons and hang out together and get our work done.
Clive, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
I had a great time. Talk to you then.
That's Clive Thompson, a journalist who covers science and technology. He recently wrote a piece looking at how the COVID-19 pandemic is changing the work landscape and where we work. He wrote that for the New York Times Magazine. Coming up after the news, the nation is looking back at past disease outbreaks to find lessons for today. We'll look back at the rise of AIDS, how it affected Wisconsin, and how the state reacted. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how political polling is changing amid the COVID-19 pandemic. First, every public health crisis is complex and requires its own unique set of actions, but there are patterns and parallels from one outbreak to another. In the early 1980s, the nation experienced the beginnings of what would later be known as AIDS. But the early years included a lot of confusion, misinformation, and missteps that meant more cases and more lives at risk. Former State Representative David Clarenbach is a Wisconsin Democratic politician and gay activist who served 9 terms in the Wisconsin State Assembly. He's featured in the new WisContext piece out today titled How AIDS Pushed Wisconsin to Change Its Approach to Public Health. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always glad to be part of the conversation.
Well, take us back, David, to those early days of the 80s and this disease that we came to know as AIDS later was just emerging on the coast. What did things look like from your vantage point here in Wisconsin?
Well, it indeed seems like a long, long time ago and a galaxy far, far away even. We took advantage of the early experiences of California and even New York City to try to devise some preemptive systems so that we would be better prepared in Wisconsin when the epidemic hit here. I always kind of described it as a time bomb that had not yet exploded. Most people, vast majority of people who were HIV positive had no idea that they were HIV positive. But I think we in Wisconsin, maybe some unique sets of circumstances here, we were able to make more progress than perhaps some other states.
What kind of concrete changes did you and your colleagues in the legislature advance at that time?
Really, the two most important things we were able to accomplish was the prohibition against discrimination based on HIV status. Of course, in the early time, it wasn't HIV, it was HTLV-3. That individuals could not be fired from their jobs, for instance, because they were HIV positive. And second, that we imposed some very strict privacy limitations on the disclosure of HIV test results. The potential for mass hysteria and the inherent homophobia that obviously still exists today but was rampant back then had a chilling effect on individuals' likelihood of getting tested. And just as with COVID today, really the key to the addressing the epidemic of AIDS is testing, testing, testing. And no one's going to get tested if they think they're going to lose their job as a result. So we put in, this was even before the HIPAA federal requirements on privacy, we worked very closely with the state epidemiologist, but also the medical society and the hospital association and even the insurance industry to try to set up some of these safeguards.
You were a Democrat in the assembly. Was there bipartisan cooperation to make these changes?
There was indeed, and that's what makes it such a different era. There was a sense of collegial respect. There was discussion and compromise. And I know that sounds pretty Pollyannish in today's world, but we couldn't have done what we did in those things in the AIDS field without bipartisan support. You know, Wisconsin was the first state to have a gay rights law to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation in employment, housing, or public accommodations. It was signed into law by a Republican governor, and the votes in both houses of the legislature, the margin of victory, were provided by Republican votes. So that, and in all of these AIDS legislation that we enacted, there were likewise bipartisan support, and that was crucial to remove the politics of it. I think we see today with the COVID pandemic, so much of the, whether you're going to wear a mask or get tested or how many tests we conduct, have become political fodder, and we were able to escape that to a large degree in Wisconsin because we thought ahead a few steps on how we might want to deal with the AIDS epidemic.
Talking to former Wisconsin State Assembly Representative David Clarenbach, looking back at how Wisconsin experienced and reacted to the rise of AIDS in the 1980s and beyond. A big question now, David, with COVID-19 has been, you know, whose job is it to take the lead? Is it the federal government, state, local, whatever? Looking back at AIDS, what did you see in the division of labor between you know, what we heard from the federal government, what you were doing at the state level?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't really have much of a choice, as you perhaps may recall, or some people of my generation at least would recall, that the word AIDS was not spoken by President Reagan until several years after our efforts became law. The federal government was of virtually no value until the Ryan White Act provided some funds to the states. So we felt that we were kind of on our own. It was the Wild West days of epidemics. I mean, we had not had one for, I guess at that time, 70 or 80 years. And we were kind of running blind. So we tried to take some lessons from California and New York, But we also, I think, charted our own course to try to make the system of public health work without the kind of hysteria and the politicization of the disease. It's a healthcare issue. It's a public health crisis. It's not politics.
Do you think it's possible to recreate that today, given what you were talking about with the politicization of so many elements of COVID-19 that we have right now?
I don't know that it is possible. It's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. And I think our political discourse in general terms seems so poisoned today. And even on an issue like this, where there's not the stigmatization that AIDS had, because after all, a vast majority at that time of people who were being infected were homosexuals. Now talk about a stigma. Today, there isn't even that kind of stigma with COVID-19 infections, yet it is far more political than AIDS ever was in Wisconsin. So I'm very discouraged, and I hope that we can come to our collective senses. I'm hopeful, but I'm not particularly optimistic.
David, we had a caller call in and mention that they thought the state did a good job of getting education in schools so kids could understand what was going on. Can you talk about that, the educational outreach efforts we saw in Wisconsin?
Well, the administration of Governor Tony Earle was very aggressive in establishing a task force on AIDS and HIV infection. And it was composed of not only experts in the field, epidemiologically speaking, but also people who were openly gay and educators. And public hearings were held around the state to try to ease the discussion into the school system. And you're absolutely right. That was one of the keys for our success with respect to AIDS. You know, there was even a member of the, I think, school board in Racine or Kenosha who was opposed to having gay teachers in schools, much less education about AIDS or HIV infection, because that gets so close to sex education in schools. And there's still a lot of opposition to things like that. But we did have a much more open and more progressive approach to the public health crisis and education of the citizenry, which out of necessity must begin before the age individuals become sexually active.
In our last few moments, David, can you share a lesson you think we should be learning today on COVID-19 from the rise of AIDS?
Well, I do hope that when we do come to our senses, that we recognize that this is part and parcel of a slightly broken healthcare system, and that we have not had in place the kind of rigorous testing or even the personal protective equipment necessary to treat people who are sick with COVID-19. And that would be the lesson that I would hope that we would learn. That is to be proactive and anticipate the needs before they hit us in the face.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's former Wisconsin State Assembly Representative David Clarenbach, a Democrat and gay activist who served 9 terms in the Wisconsin State Assembly. You can find the WisContext article with a lot more information. The title is How AIDS Pushed Wisconsin to Change Its Approach to Public Health. Find that at WisContext.org. Coming up, COVID-19 is changing everything from how we work to how we shop. It's also impacting how political polling works. We'll learn more next coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest makes the case that we can learn lessons about a slower pace of life during the current pandemic. First, 2 big polls came out in the last couple of days looking, among other things, at the presidential race here in Wisconsin. They show former Vice President Joe Biden with a lead here in the state over President Donald Trump, and that lead has been growing. But how much should we read into polls this far ahead of Election Day? And does polling work differently during a pandemic? Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Shalom. My goodness. I feel like it's been ages since
it has been. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while, and it feels like it's been ages since I've left my apartment here in New York. But you know what? Better safe than sorry.
All right, Harry. I know you are paying attention to these polls. You're paying attention to Wisconsin. We're kind of a big deal in the presidential race. How much can we read into elections showing one candidate with a lead, you know, 4.5 months or so out from Election Day?
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the facts. First, we should obviously establish the fact that Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is in a lot of trouble in Wisconsin, right? The average polls has him there down right now by about 10 points. That pretty much matches the deficit he faces nationally. And look, there are candidates who have come back from such deficits. My most infamous example is Harry Truman in 1948, was basically down by around 10 points in June of 1948 and came back and won. But the fact is, if you were to really go across time, a 10-point deficit for an incumbent is not where you want to be. It's about where Jimmy Carter was down in the polls for Ronald Reagan at this point. And while there's certainly the chance for the polls to move, you'd much rather be up 10 points than down 10 points.
Some people have reacted, and I think some Republicans saying don't despair and some Democrats saying don't get complacent, saying, hey, wait a minute, Hillary Clinton was up in the polls at this point over Donald Trump 4 years ago, and look what happened in Wisconsin. Do you see differences there?
I do. I mean, first off, let's point out that if you had the same polling error, let's say these were the polls on Election Day, right, that Biden was up by 10 and you applied the 2016 polling error that occurred in Wisconsin, Joe Biden would still win. That's how large his lead is in Wisconsin right now. More generally speaking, if you were to look nationally, Biden's up by about 10 right now nationally. Hillary Clinton was only up by about 5 or 6 at this point. And perhaps most importantly, when you're looking at the numbers, Joe Biden is above 50% in the polls. He already has more than half the electorate saying they're willing to vote for him. Hillary Clinton was only polling in the low to mid 40s at this point, with a lot of voters saying that they were either undecided or they were potentially going to choose a third party candidate. So Biden, much better position right now.
All right, I'm going to bring up a question I've brought up years ago, and I think you probably get it a lot, Harry. People saying, wait a minute, didn't 2016 prove that polling doesn't work?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I was just on a Zoom call with someone. It's so funny. During this pandemic, I'm meeting people on Zoom calls that I might not otherwise have potentially spoken to, brought up the exact same point, and he brings it up over and over and over again. And here's what I'll say. The fact is that the national polls in 2016 had Hillary Clinton winning the national popular vote by 3 to 4 points, and she won by 2 points. The polls were really, really close in the national polls. So we can really take that national polling lead for Biden much more to heart than he really is ahead. And if you look at 2018, the national polls had the Democrats winning the national House vote by about 8 to 9 points. That's exactly the margin they won it by. And while Wisconsin certainly had a polling error in 2016, remember that in 2018, the Marquette University Law School poll done by Charles Franklin, who's a great guy, had Scott Walker basically tied right at the end with your current governor. And obviously, your current governor won by a point. So the polls actually were much better in 2018 in Wisconsin than they were in 2016.
Now, one dynamic, and correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, Harry, I seem to remember that, you know, there's a big part of the electorate that didn't like Donald Trump and didn't like Hillary Clinton. Come Election Day here in Wisconsin and some other places, a big majority of those voters, though we don't like either of them, split to Donald Trump. Do you see a dynamic like that this time around, potentially?
Yeah. So a few ways that I would answer that. Number one, it's true. You know, if you were to look last time nationally, I believe it was 18% of the electorate in the exit poll said they had an unfavorable view of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and they went for Donald Trump by 17 points. Right now, if you were to look at the polls, it's a lower percentage who say they have an unfavorable view of both, closer to 10% than, say, 17% or 18%. And more than that, those voters who say they have an unfavorable view of both, Joe Biden, poll after poll after poll, is winning them overwhelmingly. The voters right now who have an unfavorable view of both tend to be younger voters. They are going heavily for Joe Biden versus the last time the voters who had an unfavorable view of both tended to be more Republican leaning. And right now, most Republicans are already behind Donald Trump. So there isn't as much room for potential surprise growth there.
Talking to Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics, about political polling, what it means, what we can and can't learn from it. Harry, how has COVID-19, if at all, changed polling and how it works and what it means?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it affects it in basically two ways. Number one, the good news is that over the long term, we have been seeing a decline in response rates in most political polls, right? At one point, you know, in a dream world long, long ago, you could expect 50% plus response rate. That was a long time ago. And it's really been sliding down to 10% or less over the past few years. The response rates have actually kicked up a little bit during the COVID-19 crisis, in part because of what we've been discussing during this call. People want to talk. They're stuck inside. They'll talk to anybody. So we really have seen response rates actually climb a little bit, which may mean something for the accuracy of polls, perhaps make them a little bit more reliable. The other way that polling has sort of been affected is that obviously people normally, if you're going to, you know, do a live telephone poll, these people are normally in call centers, and a lot of those call centers have been shut down, which means that a lot of these pollsters are working from home, which they can do. Or second, there are some pollsters who might have exported the work to another company, or perhaps they might go and use online polls instead of live interview polls just because it's easier during this pandemic.
Now, how about our voting behavior? And I'm guessing it's too soon to tell because we only have a few elections to work with, but you know, some people might not want to go to a poll, maybe, or not want to go and vote in person. Maybe they're going to vote by mail. Maybe they don't vote at all. Does that cast any uncertainty on what happens when we call and ask people how they're going to vote?
You know, the way that I think it might, and, you know, we certainly have seen a lot more people voting by mail in the latest round of primaries than we normally have, and I expect that to hold through the fall. I think the way it could potentially impact things, and we'll have to keep an eye out on this, is understanding who is likely to vote, right? Because at the end of the day, what you're interested in, if you're trying to call an election one way or another, is those people who are actually going to cast the ballot. And it could be the case that mail-in, that the fact that we have the pandemic may cause lower turnout rates, but in fact, it could cause higher turnout rates, especially if, as is the case in some states and some counties, voters are getting sent absentee request forms, or in some states actually even getting sent the ballot. And that could, in fact, make it easier to vote. So I think it's something that we're really going to have to keep an eye on. I'm not sure at this point who it might hurt or help, but it's certainly something that could impact the polls.
Let's talk about calling winners on election nights. This is going to be hard, I think, because part of that is done with exit polls where you ask people as they leave the voting station who they voted for. You can't ask an absentee ballot that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that the way that we call winners and losers on election night is going to change tremendously. And I would really plead for patience, right? It's much more important to get it right than to do it fast. And it's going to take a long time for the ballots to be counted. You know, in a number of states, we've already seen that. A lot of these states aren't used to getting so many absentee votes, so being able to count those in the most accurate way possible. And more than that, being able to figure out who's going to vote and how to reach them in terms of exit polls and pre-election surveys. Because normally how it would work, right, is in mail-in states, you might, exit pollsters might call, place a lot of calls to people before, just before the election. And just figuring out that correct mix of in-day voting versus before voting is a very tricky thing that pollsters are going to have to figure out. So I would expect a much slower result. And we're going to know the result not nearly as quickly as perhaps we might otherwise this year.
In our last minute or so, Harry, is Wisconsin going to be the tipping point state in November?
You know, this is a great question. Obviously, it was in 2016, the state that had the median electoral vote plus one that helped put Donald Trump over the top. There's a decent shot of it, but it's basically probably going to be a contest, say, between states like Pennsylvania, Florida, Wisconsin, and Arizona. But the fact that Donald Trump is down 10 at this point in Wisconsin, I think tells you all you need to know about the state of the race nationally.
And we're probably going to, we had Vice President Pence here. We've got President Trump here today, a Democratic convention, whatever that looks like, in Milwaukee coming up. We're going to get a lot of love.
You're going to, trust me, you're going to get more love than you could possibly imagine. It's like bringing 20 puppies into the room at once. That's how much all the different politicians are going to love you.
Harry, thank you so much. Good to talk to you again.
Shalom. Be well, my friend.
You too. That's Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. He joined us today to talk about how political polling has been impacted by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and for a look at some of the latest polls here in Wisconsin and around the country and what they could mean for the November election. You could still share your thoughts. Are you watching the polls? Are you steering clear of them? Do you believe them? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. Or you can email us ideas at WPR.org. Again, ideas at WPR.org. As restaurants and entertainment venues try to reopen safely during the ongoing pandemic, some have gotten creative with social distancing while still trying to look like lively places to be. You might have seen pictures online of restaurants and diners that fill some of their seating areas with mannequins. Sometimes it looks cool, sometimes kind of creepy. But as reported by NPR, an opera house in Barcelona, Spain, took things to a new level this week. On Monday, they hosted their first performance since March. It was a string quartet, and that quartet performed in front of a packed house. Every one of the 2,292 seats was occupied by a potted plant. While the plant world took up all the space in the live performance, animal life forms could watch the show online. Now, the plants were provided by local nurseries, and after they took in some high culture, they were then donated to healthcare professionals at a Barcelona hospital. That was a thank you for their work when Spain was hit hard by the novel coronavirus. Here's a little taste of what those plants might have gotten to listen to. Some Puccini. This is Central Time.